Hi, I'm Dave Summers, and welcome to AMA's Edgewise, where you will hear fresh insights from recognized thought leaders across a wide range of subject matters. AMA's Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. The AMA is a global leader in professional development and education, improving the immediate performance and long-term growth of individuals and organizations. Check us out on our website, www.amanet.org. India has the world's fourth largest economy, the largest youth population, and the current ranking of the second most preferred destination for foreign investment. Yet, its importance to the worldwide market seems to be swept under the rug. Rafiq Dasani discusses India's growing role in the global economy in his new book, India Arriving, published by Emicom Books. Rafiq's book provides a deeper understanding of a country that promises to be the next major player in the world economy. Rafiq Dasani is a senior research scholar and the executive director of the South Asia Initiative at Stanford University's Asian Pacific Research Center. Rafiq was the CEO of the Robert Fleming Investment Group's India operations. He was editor of Business India Weekly and was also a professor of finance at Pennsylvania State University. Welcome to the program, Rafiq.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
For a Western business person, is India at this point more of a place to just outsource software services or call centers? You know, I call AOL or I call my bank or whatever, and obviously it's a person from India. Is that primarily what it's about right now?
Well, India has become the world's largest market for many things other than software services and call centers. You know, it's the largest market, for example, today for telecommunications, for airline services. So it's already much more than a place, just a place to outsource software development and call center work. That said, in manufacturing, India lags behind several Asian countries. This is primarily because the quality of the blue-collar workforce is still very weak. You know, for decades, the state neglected primary and secondary education and chose to focus its resources on higher education. And the result has been the absence of a pool of reasonably educated workers who could join the manufacturing workforce.
Which aspects of working with India would a Westerner such as myself find similar to my own working environment?
I think the thing that would be found most similar is that the legal, the professional systems, the regulatory systems are very similar. You know, the quality of Indian lawyers, consultants, accountants, and other professional service providers are on par with the world's best. Another example is the Indian financial markets. Let me take stock markets as an example. In terms of their liquidity and transparency, they're as developed as Western stock markets. This goes back to their long history. They're over a century old. In terms of trading volume, after the NYSE and the NASDAQ, the next two largest stock markets are the Indian National Stock Exchange and the Bombay Stock Exchange. The reason is quite interesting. You know, oddly, perhaps for a Westerner, the growth of stock markets has been a socialist goal. The Indian government, during its socialist phase, always took the view that stock markets are the best institutions for sharing wealth and preventing the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few privately owned firms. So they worked very hard to make it easy for small investors to access stock markets. As a result, financial markets are very cheap, very simple to access for everyone.
Let's talk for a second about the relationship between India and America, the United States right now. Just spend a little while here discussing with us about the state of current state of relations between the two countries, and also, I mean, what does the future look like?
Well, both India and the U.S. have invested a lot in recent times in improving their relations. It's been a slow process after the Cold War ended. It's not just on security issues that they've cooperated. You know, India has been diligent about its obligations to the World Trade Organization, the WTO, for instance. In fields such as intellectual property protection, India's done a better job of compliance with WTO obligations and norms than any other developing country. And the U.S. in turn has encouraged its businesses to invest in India. It recently reached a landmark agreement on supplying nuclear fuel. This agreement, of course, is not particularly substantive for India's development, since nuclear power remains a strategic rather than a commercial option. It does, however, signal a coming to age of global status, something that Indian policymakers have long sought. that is to be treated on par with developed countries. Nevertheless, you know, I often find that Westerners, including American policymakers, have a limited understanding of how Indian politics work. You know, despite the mantra of repeated within the U.S. itself that all politics is local, they feel puzzled that the nuclear deal currently is being opposed by so many parties in India. They ask, how can something that frees India's domestic nuclear fuel for pursuing its own programs, whether they be of weaponization or development, and which enables India to access global supplies of nuclear fuel at some risk of proliferation, why should that not be uniformly be viewed positively in India? You know, a second aspect that Westerners should be aware of about India is that, like its great neighbor to the east, China, India has ambitions of joining the global elite. The U.S. saw China slipping away from its grasp in a relatively short period of time. In the early 1990s, in the first few years of the Clinton administration, building a long-term relationship with China was America's primary foreign policy preoccupation. It didn't work for reasons, of course, too long to go into here. But now America hopes to do the same with India. It believes that India's democratic traditions will make it easier. But as we just discussed, you know, it's not a slam dunk. Indian democracy is of its own type. Also, as any country develops its own cultures and prejudices will be more evident, you know, as true for the U.S. as for India. For the moment, their interests, that of the U.S. and India, are aligned. But a decade from now, conflicts will undoubtedly emerge. So how India and America build their relationship now, the building blocks, will be crucial to determining future relations with India.
Can you just spend a second describing to us the role of the Indian government as it relates to business and business growth in India?
Yes, certainly glad to do that. You know, the thing is that India is, as most or many Americans will know, is the world's largest democracy. Now, often this means that Westerners then think that this means that Indian democracy is like the American, only larger. They don't know usually about the other aspects, you know, regionalism, caste issues, very centralized control of politics and economics that the Indian government exercises. They also wouldn't be aware, for example, about the role of the rural voter in the U.S., you know, which is largely an urban country. The rich vote and the poor don't. In India, it's exactly the opposite. You know, the rich vote at the rate of 20-30% or less, and the poor vote at 80% or more. But it's really rural India that drives governance in the country, and that has some fundamental aspects of how the country works as far as outsiders are concerned.
I think many people, particularly in the United States, who have a limited amount of information tend to parallel or equate India to China in terms of foreign relationships or business opportunities. Can you share with us, in what ways does India differ from China?
Well, you know, the difference that's most spoken about is that India is a democracy and China is not. Through Western eyes, this gives India an advantage because we live in a democracy in the West and have done rather well as a result. The reality is that China has done much better than India in providing health care, basic education, and a livable environment for many decades now. From that, one would not unreasonably conclude that in some fundamental ways, such as life expectancy or the status of women in society, India's democratic traditions have delivered less to its citizens than China's autocracy has given the Chinese. But one needs to probe more into this. I mean, I go into this in great detail in the book, and I find that in many ways India and China are similar in the power of local bureaucrats. So despite India being this democracy, power tends to be centralized at the capital in New Delhi, but at the local level where it matters for things like how healthcare is done or how primary education is delivered, it's bureaucratically driven, and because China has had a system of command politics that is less affected by democratic issues, it's been able to do better. On the other hand, there are certain similarities that result from this similarity in governance structure. Endemic corruption, the weakness of civil society are both features of both India and China. But there are some differences that are really fascinating, which I'd like to mention. One is the growth in the services sector in India versus China's growth in manufacturing. Why was this? In China, the state decided that manufacturing would be open to private investment and services would not. India, on the other hand, responded to the political power of business once it reformed in the 1990s. the private sector then told the government that, look, we can do everything. So the government said, good, do it. Some of the effects have been very positive. For example, in less than a decade, in areas such as telecommunications and airlines, India moved from being one of the most backward countries in the world to being the most dynamic, even overtaking China. For example, while China took 2 decades to build a dynamic telecommunications sector that today adds 6 million new cell phone users every month, India, within 6 years, that's from 2001, has gone from almost zero cell phone users to adding 8 million new users every month. That's the equivalent of 3 new cell phone connections every second. Another example is IT. Thanks entirely to private initiative, the Indian IT sector creates 3 new jobs every minute of each working day, a rate that even the US IT sector has never seen. So there are pluses and minuses, as I discuss.
As a concluding question here, I'm kind of very curious. We've talked a lot about what American perceptions are about India and its evolving and changing role, but what do you think Indians reading your book will find out? What new stuff will they find out about India?
You know, in researching this book, I traveled extensively. I went to rural India. Of course, I'd been doing that for decades, and every year anyway, I make several trips to India for my research work in any case. But the thing is that urban India has always been urban. It's not like America, where most urban residents would find, if they went 2 or 3 generations back, that they have an ancestor who comes from rural areas. That's not the case in India. So there's a divide between rural and urban India, because for generations, urban India has always been urban, and rural India hardly migrated. So I found that the real India is often hidden even from the average resident of urban India. For example, in my research, I discovered that about a third of the rural population has a food intake that is 30% below the minimum daily calorific requirement. It's about 1,500 to 1,600 calories a day, and they need about 2,200, 2,300. The urban areas get that. The rural areas which produce the food for urban India are starving. And when I mentioned this and I gave the stories of my own experiences in this, it was an eye-opening statistic for them. So I think there's a lot of that urban India and policymakers and those involved with governance and development need to learn about their own country. So that was an interesting aspect. Another was the way politics works. For example, the importance of caste issues. You know, in India, it's now said in the rural areas that you don't cast your vote, you vote your caste. Mm-hmm. That thing the urban dweller does not understand, but needs to, because that's what determines government in India. The ability of these very small towns to have 40, 50 software exporting firms. Even when I went to Bangalore and I said I saw this in small towns in India, and they said, oh, really? We didn't know about this. So I hope there's a lot to interest Indians as well.
Absolutely. I'm sure there absolutely is here. Well, we've been speaking today to Rafiq Dasani. He's the author of a new book, India Arriving. Rafiq, thank you for spending time with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
India Arriving is one of AMICOM's featured books of the month. AMICOM is actually the publishing arm of the American Management Association. With us here today are two executive editors from AMICOM, Christina Parisi and Jacqueline Flynn. Welcome. Happy to have you here. Christina, let's start with you. I understand you want to talk to us about a couple of interesting titles that are coming up.
Sure. We have a great book called A Class with Drucker. Most people know Peter Drucker as the father of modern management, but his real talent was teaching, and our author, William Cohen, was one of the privileged few who studied with Drucker. He not only was one of the first graduates of the Drucker doctoral program, but he stayed in touch with them over the years and developed a friendship. And Drucker once said he and his faculty learned as much from Bill as Bill did from them, so they were pretty close. And in this book, he shares many of Drucker's teachings that helped him. Some of his lessons are previously unpublished, things, you know, he said in the classroom or informal settings. And of course, he shows how Drucker's ideas can be applied to real world challenges that managers face today. And, you know, along with the lessons, he includes personal anecdotes, so you really get a sense of who he was as a person. So reading the book is like being in the classroom with him and feeling his passion and his energy and hearing his lessons. It's really a wonderful way to keep Drucker's message alive and relevant for today.
Also, I want to draw your attention to the fact that we have an upcoming webcast with Dr. Cohen, and that is November 7th, and it's called The Lost Lessons of Drucker, or Lost Lessons of Peter Drucker. Thank you, Christina. Jackie, what have you got for us today?
Okay, well, you may not know that in addition to our very strong business publishing program, AntMacomb has moved into a lot of other areas, and this is a book from one of them. We are very excited to be publishing a paperback edition of our award-winning book, Unplugged, Reclaiming the Right to Die in America. The author, Bill Colby, is the lawyer who represented the family of Nancy Cruzan in the first right to die case heard by the Supreme Court. The book was selected by Library Journal as a Best Consumer Health Book of the Year and also won the Independent Book Publishers Award and the American Medical Writers Award. Colby seeks to inform and enlighten readers about the current state of our rights at a most difficult time, the end of life. Many think that having a simple conversation with a family member or a living will makes your wishes known and guarantees that they will be followed when the time comes. Unfortunately, this couldn't be further from the truth. Frequently, living wills are misplaced or ignored, and family members who are grieving and uncertain about vague wishes are vulnerable to the overwhelming pressure to treat, only later to realize that they gave up the peaceful exit that they had wished for their loved one. Though this is a delicate and complex subject, he deftly unpacks the legal and medical complexities so that you will be better equipped to make decisions about end-of-life care and ultimately make sure your wishes are followed. Unplugged is also about what you need to do to protect your family and make sure control of decision-making stays where it belongs, with them, rather than the courts, legislatures, or hospital administrators.
Thank you, Jackie. And once again, the books mentioned here today, A Class with Drucker and Unplugged. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Remember, we'd really like your feedback, so please drop us an email note at podcast@amanet.org. Or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.